You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible. 14 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 9, given in Cologne on the 7th of May, 1912. Entitled Mysteries of the Kingdoms of Heaven in Parable and in Real Form. The increasing significance of theosophy for the people of today and of the near future will only slowly and gradually be appreciated. It will be understood once one has settled into an understanding of certain things, which are at present hinted at in religious and occult writings, but which are not usually taken seriously enough. One could point to thousands of places in such religious or occult literature whose depths are simply not recognized, because people only skim through them superficially. Today, I would like to paraphrase a deeply, deeply significant place in the Gospels. Quote, "Those who stand outside, to them will the mysteries be revealed in parables, so that they see and yet do not see, that they hear and yet do not hear, that they understand and yet do not comprehend. To you, however, will be revealed the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven without parables and in their true form." Close quote. Matthew 13:13 through 17. It does not usually occur to us what endless depth of meaning a passage like this contains. What does this mean? Where are the most important parables in which Christ is speaking to his apostles? The most significant parables are those which one does not normally take to be parables. Human beings take what they see in the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms around them, in the physical world, as factual reality, as things which simply exist. They see this animal or that plant and imagine that they are things which are really there, which really exist. They see processes taking place in air and water and imagine these are processes that actually exist. In fact, they do not. Because all these processes in the kingdoms of nature around us, everything taking place in air and water, are in fact processes taking place in spiritual realms, revealing themselves through what takes place on a physical level. They are manifestations of spiritual processes, and they are the true reality. Nothing other than the spiritual world is real. And only when we can recognize the spiritual in all things and processes have we in truth recognized reality. Everything in the physical world only has the value of a parable, an allegory, a cipher standing for the spiritual world that exists behind everything. We will have to learn to view every process in the animal and plant realms and everything we encounter in the human realm. Everything that makes an impression on our minds and intellects, in this way too. They are all nothing more than allegories. And only those who learn their true meaning reach actuality, arrive at reality. Human beings make their way through the world, watch all the processes taking place, and do not understand that they are merely tokens. Human beings are directly spoken to through allegories. Reality is only mentioned when we speak of the Spirit. Christ Jesus speaks to his disciples in images taken from nature, explaining processes which belong to the Spirit. He speaks of grains of wheat being sown and diverse outcomes resulting. This can only be a parable because the things of nature are themselves parables. Then, when he explains to his disciples that he is one with all that is the spiritual nature in all existence, that he must undergo death, that what lives within him must sink down into death in order to arise as a force in human hearts and souls, to be bestowed by him on all humankind through this death. Then he is speaking of reality, because he is speaking of the Spirit and of what is to take place through the Spirit. This is why real knowledge is only won once human beings have gradually forged ahead beyond the mysteries of the world, by learning to recognize all that approaches them externally as tokens, as emblems of spiritual processes. Human souls can only be fruitfully enriched when this attitude to the outer world is established. If the outer world gradually becomes suffused with spirit for human beings, they will embed themselves differently within it from the way in which they did so beforehand, and will find spiritual traces everywhere in its rhythms. We can note in ourselves an ever-repeating rhythm, that of falling asleep and waking up. We know that humans need to repeat this igniting of day consciousness and fading into sleep consciousness every 24 hours or so. If we then ask ourselves with what this alternating human rhythm of sleeping and waking can be compared in the external world, many might imagine alternating states in the plant kingdom, such as growth in spring and wilting in autumn. We see the burgeoning, sprouting of plants growing into summer, and in autumn see the fruits ripening through the power of the sun, which has been streaming inward to earth over that time. Everything appears to be extinguished during winter, only to regrow again in spring. People might compare their own waking up in the morning with this awakening of physical nature, and their own falling asleep with autumn's wilting. But this would be a grave mistake, one to which we must not subscribe if we want to see what is true. What do we experience when we fall asleep? Our astral body and our eye, capital, take their leave. They leave our physical and ether bodies. Were we to see what our physical and ether bodies were doing during the night, we would be able to observe that they are quite otherwise engaged from anything that could be compared with autumnal wilting. This can only be observed by looking down onto physical and ether bodies from the spiritual world. They can be seen behaving quite differently from the way they do during the day, because during the day they are seen to be depleting themselves, so that when we are tired of an evening, this is only a sign that we have exhausted our physical and ether bodies. Living life in full day consciousness entails ruination, death dealing to our physical and ether bodies. By evening, they are largely drained, and at this point we fall asleep. If we look at them spiritually, we see that a purely vegetative activity begins in physical and ether bodies, which can be compared with what takes place in spring. Physical and ether bodies begin as if to sprout new green growth, as if something were happening within the person that could be compared with spring in outer nature. The moment of falling asleep needs to be compared with spring, and the deeper into the night we sleep, the more what is happening within can be compared with what happens in external summer. Vegetative activity becomes ever stronger within our bodies, and by the time we wake up, our condition can be compared with autumn in outer nature. Waking consciousness is subject to forces like those that bring summer vegetation to the point of withering. Over the course of the day, a condition of such barren desertification of physical and etheric forces is reached, which can be compared with winter dreariness, when plants have withered and vegetative activity has died down. Thus, in a spiritual scientific sense, we should equate falling asleep with spring and waking up with autumn. When falling asleep, that is, in a spring-like condition, astral body and ego leave their physical and etheric counterparts. Outside in nature, it is in fact so that the spirits of the earth, which are connected with the plant kingdom, as it were, free themselves in spring from what is physical in the plant world, and that only then do they rouse themselves into a state of activity. In summer, those spiritual beings connected with the plant kingdom fall asleep, waking up in winter to permeate the entire planetary mass. One could say, while it is winter in one half of the earth, it is summer in the other half. Well, rhythmical interplay is such that the spirits of the earth, when they leave the northern hemisphere, move to the southern hemisphere. They course through the earth and encircle it rhythmically. The same happens in human beings. We believe our thinking and consciousness to reside only in our heads. When we are outside ourselves at night, we may believe that nothing remains in us that thinks. Yet in truth it is a fact that in the lower part of our bodies, a sort of thinking and consciousness that differs from the human is active. So that there too a rhythmic circulating is taking place in human bodies. In spring, we can say, now the spirits of the earth are beginning to fall asleep. They have withdrawn from the area of earth where it is summer. Here a vegetative life continues, which is similar to when human beings fall asleep and vegetative processes start in their bodies. In winter, however, earth spirits wake up. They are united with the earth in a way that is similar to humans' wakeful consciousness in daily life. When we stand on the ground in summer, we are surrounded by physical nature as it jubilates in its physicality. All plant life sprouts and burgeons, as do all the lower spiritual beings of the plant kingdom, who are the active builders of growth. In winter, on the other hand, when a covering of snow is spread across the land and over slumbering vegetative activity, we know that the highest divine beings are creating, working and weaving throughout the universe, that they are all around us, that the loftiest cosmic life and consciousness is active in the earth. This is how it is in winter, and not in summer. True spiritual science teaches us to be clear about this. Spiritual science, which is able to penetrate these matters with fully clear consciousness, knows that people who retain this not only theoretically in their heads, but who can feel it in their hearts too, will reflect, oh, you approaching forces of spring and summer, you cause everything in nature to flourish and bloom. You call elemental beings forth from the earth to work. At the height of summer, around midsummer, these elemental beings are celebrating in ecstasy, almost in a frenzied eruption. This is when the solstice and St. John's tide are celebrated. Then follow autumn and winter, and humans should feel in the depths of their souls, with the withdrawal of external physical sun forces, with the approach of winter, when outer nature dies back, as it grows ever darker and darker, it is then that the highest celestial forces are again uniting with the earth in which we live. And we feel ourselves as if enfolded within those lofty spiritual forces. We feel as though belonging among them in the most profound depths of our souls. We may feel the deepest reverence on becoming aware that with the onset of winter we may watch forces, spiritual kindred since primeval times, as they manifest in our immediate surroundings. It is theosophy or spiritual science's task to acquaint you with them and to explain their existence to humankind. We know that a task of spiritual science is to recall what humans once experienced in the dim and dreamy clairvoyance they once possessed. We are reconquering humanity's primeval heritage. This was a dreamlike, primal, clairvoyant revelation for human beings, and there are witnesses to this fact. The festival of St. John is placed near midsummer, so as to direct human consciousness to experience. Now physicality has unfurled to its zenith. Now lower elemental beings are reveling to near ecstasy in the power of their most potent forces. The festival of St. John is set by primeval human consciousness that in this ecstasy of physicality, human beings forget their spiritual element, giving themselves up to the pressing resplendence of physical nature. Yet, just as surely did those ancient seers know that in winter the most elevated of spiritual forces are united with our earthly bodies. This is why that ancient consciousness, wherever it could be active, placed the festival most intended to signify that humankind felt at one with the spiritual in the earth near midwinter at Christmas. This feast of a divine being, of the spirit of the earth, could never have been set in summer by a clairvoyantly cognizant humanity. It had to be celebrated in winter. At the time of the winter solstice did human souls feel connected with divine spiritual forces then permeating the earth. The festival of Christmas belongs in winter, just as St. John's celebration belongs in summer. Once one is aware of how the festivals speak to us in lively manner, in the sense that ancient human consciousness fixed them as it did, one can feel spiritually united with their significance. One can then appreciate how the human soul is intended to be enlivened by such knowledge. The way external physical sunlight arrives, bringing with it celestial physical forces to earth in springtime, and the way spirits withdraw to sacred spheres, just as the spirit of each human being withdraws into spiritual worlds at night, all this is wonderfully expressed in the festival of Easter, which is set such that sun, moon, and constellations are decisive in its setting. The way in which spiritual powers visibly fall asleep in spring is expressed through these constellations. It is typical of our materialistic age to consider fixing the Easter festival, thereby abandoning precisely what gives Easter its meaning, to facilitate the materialist demands of industry or commerce. What an expression of present-day materialism! It may be handy for finalizing accounts that Easter does not fall one year in March, the next in April. But precisely the fact that celestial constellations determine the setting of Easter expresses how heaven and earth work together in concert. Great primeval human wisdom resides in the setting of festivals. Commercial considerations may well prevail, and Easter may be set by external criteria, but forgetting Easter's true meaning would be a dire blow to all that humanity should cherish dearly. This is why spiritual science feels called, even if Easter is to be fixed by criteria of superficial interests, to continue counting Easter a movable feast, one which can only be set according to sun, moon, and stars. Alongside any materialistically fixed Easter, a spiritual Easter will continue to be celebrated, one which we can continue to celebrate in our hearts as being consciously connected with spiritual worlds. A spiritually celebrated Easter festival will be a parable for the spiritual process which in spring is witness to the consciousness of higher spiritual beings as they fall asleep, while the consciousness of lower spiritual entities comes to the fore. However, in autumn, those lofty spiritual powers whose consciousness has remained with the earth awaken. Once you have felt this deeply, you will gradually come to understand that human beings do entirely belong to the spirit, and that external nature is but a parable. People will ever increasingly want to discover how they relate to the spirit, not to outer nature, within this parable. We are living in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, and attention has often been directed to the fact that this age is a recapitulation of the third post-Atlantean epoch, of the Egyptian age. In the way we now live, something of ancient Egypt re-emerges in our thinking, feeling, and willing. A principal aim of the Egypto-Chaldean epoch was that people were to develop their sense of interrelatedness with the realm of stars. Astrology was founded and especially cultivated in that era. People knew clairvoyantly how the constellations were related to human life and destiny. They could see deeply into the mysterious connection between the realm of stars and human fate. There were some extraordinarily great spirits in whom this faculty continued into more recent times. They were also incarnated in the Egypto-Chaldean epochs, and in subsequent incarnations were illumined in their deeply intuitive astrological knowledge, as if by an intuitive power emanating directly from within their souls. This was the case with Julian the Apostate, who was reincarnated as Tycho Brahe. He shed light on the mysterious connection which can be thought of as existing between human destiny and the arcane structures formed by the constellations. It is considered scientifically irrefutable that Tycho Brahe was a great astronomer who discovered a number of new stars in the heavens and who drew a map of the constellations. Scientists therefore consider it forgivable that he was also an astrologer who peddled all manner of prophecies to people on the basis of the stars. They forgive him for predicting the death of Sultan Suleiman on the basis of his deep astrological knowledge when he was teaching at the University of Rostock. They also forgive him for stunning the world with this pronouncement, saying that prophecy was just a weakness to be overlooked in an otherwise great man. They even forgive him for the fact that the Sultan did die at the very moment Tycho had predicted. In Tycho Brahe we see ancient Egyptian wisdom reigniting. And this must shine into our own times, as they are a recapitulation of the Egyptian age. Nowadays we also need to seek out connections between the divine and earthly worlds. This involves not only seeking in heavenly realms, but also studying parables about, analogies with, divine realms, which are to be found in physical kingdoms. We can find them in both the greatest and the smallest matters. If we, for example, study leaf spurs in various plants, we will find that by following on the stem the line made by the sequence of budding leaf spurs, we arrive at a spiral. We notice that leaves grow in a rhythmic spiral sequence around a stiff stem. In other plants, such as bindweed, it is the stem itself that creates the spiral. Most people do not notice things like this. Were you to study something of this kind, you would make new discoveries. You would discover that such spiral formations are dependent on forces not present on Earth, but which exert their influence downward from the planets. These planets inscribe spirals in space and cause plants to make similar spirals around their stems. Yet the stem grows upward from below, and this motion bisects the spiraling forces. This is the force that concludes at the tip, preparing the blossom to emerge. This force radiates outward to the sun and back. Each species of plant is assigned to one planet or another and their respective movements. A time will come when we will know how Venus or other planets move. This will not be discovered by external astronomical data, but by studying how those plants, which are entities of Venus, reflect in their microcosmic spirals Venus's unequivocal track. Up yonder, Venus inscribes her great spirals into cosmic space, and the plants mimic her movement in their own small spirals. The planets inscribe their script, imprinting it into the earth, and the sun forms their conclusion, pouring itself over everything and reigning supreme over what the planets have created. The cooperative work between earth and celestial realms will be studied in the spiral growth of plants. The growth of plants is a parable for facts concerning spiritual beings in cosmic space. In this way, cosmic correlations will be found between each physical entity and cosmic space. One will be able to link them to events in the cosmos, and in this way one will gradually find one's way as to where minerals, plants, animals, and even humans, in their deeds and destinies, find their corresponding realm of affiliation. We will study such things in their small beginnings, as we have done today, in the light of spiritual science. It will be a long time before science travels these paths, till it studies such things in their true contexts, on the basis of occult sources, but happen it must. If one relates to the world in the context of present-day evolution and takes everything outward as a sign, allegory, or parable, a guideline will be found in our title, Soul Calendar. But you should not think that the signs for the zodiac images represent those constellations themselves. The sign of Capricorn does not represent the constellation of Capricorn, but means that the sun or the moon stands in a certain relationship to this constellation, activating particular forces there. These signs do not represent things placed in space, but forces that are active there, be it in this or that way. What we call space is mere make-believe. Spiritual forces exert their influences from everywhere, and how they do this is expressed in those signs. When the sun rises of a morning above, say, the constellation of Pisces, this constellation is the expression of distinct forces emanating from spiritual beings and raying down to earth. We can feel all this, and we can transform it into imaginative knowledge. What can burgeon forth from our souls when we really feel what radiates toward us from the spiritual world? This is what we were trying to express in the title Soul Calendar, brought out this year within the Theosophical movement. In it, you find signs that differ from the old traditional calendar symbols in an attempt to express what souls of today need to learn anew. They arose as a result of following, in feeling, not intellect, what we observed as those alternating rhythms on earth. How spiritual beings connected with earth fall asleep in spring and reawaken in autumn. A renewal of aspects such as this, festivals into which age-old clairvoyant wisdom has been poured, is essential. Festivals have to be renewed, because in this fifth post-Atlantean age, the heritage of wisdom from the third age is to be resurrected. It must strike outsiders as highly irrational to start our calendar in 1879. We simply wanted to emphasize how exceptionally important it is to place the mystery of Golgotha as the starting point of our calculated time, and not the year of Jesus' birth. The mystery of Golgotha took place on a Friday, the 3rd of April, in the year 33, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And this is the time of the birth of the I capital, in the sense that we have often referred to it. It does not matter where on earth a person lives, nor to which religion they adhere. What entered the world through the mystery of Golgotha is for all humankind. Just as the particular day Caesar died is applicable the world over, and not on another day for the Chinese and a different one for Indians, so it is a simple fact of spiritual life that the mystery of Golgotha took place at that time, and that here we are dealing with the birth of the human I. It is a matter of international fact. One has to wonder that from some quarters it is claimed that what goes on here in our Rosicrucian theosophy, which places the mystery of Golgotha at the very center of everything, should be cut out solely for German consumption and be unsuitable for other peoples. Where things of this kind are stated, no inclination is shown to get to grips with the matter in hand. Nothing is understood about Christ and the mystery of Golgotha. Distortions are put out into the world, and unfortunately, distortions are believed. Yet it is a sacred duty to protect people from error, even though it can be no pleasant task telling them such truths. But it has to be done. In other places it is said that the same rights apply to everyone, yet one breaks this rule oneself. It is not a matter of saying this or that and printing it, but that truth should prevail amongst us, and that truth becomes our sacred law. We want to bring the birth of the I to expression in our calendar. But this means actually taking the moment of that birth as our starting point. This is why we counted from Easter to Easter instead of New Year to New Year. Were this to cause further annoyance, derision, and sneering, this need disturb us little, because we know that had we only ever wanted to repeat old, well-worn traditions, no new life would ever come about. Sameness, endlessly repeated, is death. Differentness, slipped into sameness, is life. Our calendar is a project for life. And if we have done it badly to date, we will do it better next year. Most important, however, is part two of the soul calendar. There I try to assemble, week by week, meditations formulated in such a way that souls can live through them inwardly, meditatively, and which have the effect on souls of making the connection between their own inner experience and what is directed over the course of time by divine spiritual beings. These meditations can lead to truly experiencing these spiritual beings if they are carried through seriously and with devotion. Lengthy occult experience and research have been compressed into these 52 formulations, which can serve as time blueprints for an inner life of soul, linking it to processes in divine spiritual experience. They constitute something timeless that can represent the correlation between what is spiritual and what is sense perceptible. Anyone will be able over time to appreciate the value of this title, Soul Calendar, and will retain its meaning forever, gradually finding their way from the human soul out to the spirit, which inhabits and weaves throughout the universe. It will not be easy to make these meditations one's own in their deepest significance. Souls will take years and years to do that. This calendar doesn't merely document notions that suddenly cropped up, but is a deed which relates organically to our whole movement, where it will eventually be seen why some of its contents are created in one way, while others are done differently. The end of Lecture 9.